Welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast with me, Sam Harris, your host. I invite fascinating humans from all walks of life to share their wisdom and unpack their mindsets and formulas for growth. Hello and welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Debbie Wasko, whose name I researched. I watched four different YouTube videos to see how people said your name, and they're Wasko, Waskow, Wasko, and I was like,
Wasko, yeah.
Okay, Wasko, I got it right. I was supposed to ask that, but failed to until I then said it, and then was like, oh, great, I'm unsure of myself. Anyway, Debbie Wasko, delighted to meet you, the co-founder of Allbright, a club and community that connects smart-minded women through digital and physical spaces. They drive positive change for women in business, which is a positive outcome for all of us, I truly believe. You are also a member of the Mayor of London's Business Advisory Board, which is cool, and the former CEO of Love Home Swap, a subscription-based home exchange business, which you sold in 2017, and have generally been very influential in the whole sharing economy, writing an actual report for government about the sharing economy, which is known as the Wasko Report, which, again, really cool. So I'm very excited to talk to you about how you've been so influential in the world of business and how you've gone into just driving change for making the world a better place. So firstly, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
My pleasure. So yeah, I'd love to understand a bit about you from like earlier on in life. So what kind of mindsets did you learn, do you think, as a child that kind of became a theme for your life, and how might you teach those to others?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that you think about as you get a bit older and you try to understand why you've had the career that you have. And my career has been relatively unusual, and particularly unusual for a woman, in that I started my first business when I was 25, and I've built and exited three businesses over the last 20 years. I think a lot of it, when I look at it, is that I grew up in a very entrepreneurial family. They wouldn't have described themselves as entrepreneurs, so that's quite a grand word, but I was a classic third generation Jewish immigrant family where I didn't grow up with any role models who had actual jobs. Everybody in my family ran their own small business. In particular, my grandmother and my mother were both entrepreneurs. My grandmother built up a chain of sweet shops and off licenses in the north of England, and she died a few years ago, age 97, and is greatly missed. And some of my formative memories were driving around with my grandma in her armored vehicle, dropping money off at the bank. She never learned how to reverse, by the way, which is something that we have in common because I'm a terrible driver. And my mum was a mother of five and an entrepreneur. So I think if I try to map that back onto mindset, I grew up seeing women be matriarchs and run their own businesses. I grew up in an environment where business was discussed around the kitchen table. And as is classic for immigrant families, where academic excellence was non-negotiable, so we all had to do really well at school. But also there was a real sense of self-determination, I suppose, that anything was possible, for women and girls, and that we had to all be the best we could be. And if I look at my siblings, I'm one of five, everybody works for themselves in some shape or form. Love Home Swap, sort of jump ahead, I worked with my brother and Ben, my youngest brother, for about a decade on and off, which was a brilliant experience. I think there's something in the gene pool, but in the nature-nurture mix around self-determination, being the best that you can be and standing for something. You know, that was also really important in my family, to have a voice, to be heard, to stand for something. And I think about it a lot because I'm a mum of three. And I think about what it is that my kids have lived and seen. And they've been around a mum who has always worked, has always had her own businesses. Because of the nature of me being a mum, where I was a single mum to two of them for a long time, they always came with me to work and in and out of work and on and off planes. And I see it in them that they feel like it's an extremely natural way to live and be, to run your own business. And they themselves, particularly my son, who's 13, are mini entrepreneurs. During the pandemic, he created a chili farm on our roof and set up the ultimate chili farmer, he was for a bit. And whilst he'd done all of the business plan and the PowerPoint, and we live on a communal garden, so he got together his management team of kids and they would meet in our garden. He had a massive supply chain problem because the chilies were being eaten by their birds on the roof. So I kind of, you know, real early lesson for him in the importance of execution and making sure that you can create a product first. So honestly, I think for women, which is my dog in the fight because of Albright, which we'll get onto, you've got to see it to be it. And you've got to see women in your life acting as role models. And I was extremely lucky to have that in my family DNA.
Yeah, that's a reflection on your life and upbringing. Thank you. And a really important lesson that I do think just having role models is huge. And it's certainly missing more for many women than... On my family, my gran was similarly entrepreneurial. She ran a few different businesses, like a newspaper businessy, like shop chain. And then I did a lot of dress, and she was constantly baking and doing lots of arts and crafts, which is cool. And then her mum ran like fashion sort of factories and things. And so, yeah, it was super in the family. And also, a different tangent, my great aunt can't turn right when she's driving, but she still drives, which is amazing, because you don't actually technically need to turn right as long as you always turn left. But it's
I can relate to that stuff.
Yeah. But yeah, it's super interesting how many of you are also entrepreneurial, and it's just epidemic. Well, not epidemic, you know what I mean? It's in like epistemic. I don't know, I'm not great at English, considering that I am English. You'd think I would be better. But throughout your entire family, the entrepreneurial genes and inspiration is high, which is cool. And so you said that like actually just being able to have role models is such a huge thing. So do you think that's the main reason that inspired you to start Albright? Or do you also want to just help connect people and make it easier to start a business? Or is it just a mix of things?
Albright is about the stage that I'm at in my career. And it's about a moment of serendipity. And I'm a big believer that the best things that happen in your life are because of the people that you meet. So the story behind Albright was that I had sold Love Home Swap just over 4 years ago now, which was a big deal. I sold it to Wyndham, the hospitality group. And shortly before I sold, I went to a party that I almost didn't go to of one of the parents at the school of my eldest child. And the father said to me, there's someone I want you to meet. And he introduced me to a woman called Anna Jones, who at the time was the CEO of Hearst. And your life can change in an instant, depending on who you meet. You know, my mother always said to me that you would never meet the man of your dreams in your kitchen, which, of course, is true about men, but true about life. That, and that's such a slight reflection on the pandemic and Albright, that I really feel like women need to be in the room. And I met Anna. We did a lot of riffing on life, the universe and everything, but primarily, where are all the women? In my world, as a female founder who raises capital, women don't raise capital, women don't invest capital. The stats pre the pandemic was 2.17% of capital in 2019 went to back a female CEO. And that feels like a heady height now, because post the pandemic, it's down to 1%. 1% of the Future Fund, which was the emergency funding put in place by the UK government, went to back women. And yet women deliver better returns than men, 35% better on average. So backing women is just a great untapped asset class, as well as something that, you know, is good for society, and diverse teams produce better results. And in AJ's world, she was the only female CEO of a media business in the UK, the only female CEO in Hearst history, despite the fact that his titles are 85% targeted at women. And. So Albright became our response to our lived experience as being the only women in the room, and is an attempt to build a monster global sisterhood for women, so that smart-minded, ambitious women have a network, whether they are entrepreneurs or executives or freelancers or consultants, or they're pivoting in their careers. And we do that through building out that network digitally. So we've got an app, which is like a masterclass meets LinkedIn for women, a freemium model with a paywall. But also we have physical spaces, which are our Albright members clubs, female-only members, enlightened men very welcome as our guests. And as we scale up the business, they really act as flagships for our movement and our mission. And I'm sitting in one at the moment, which is full of amazing and diverse women doing different things. And it's a really powerful call to action and a further indicative statement that women need to be in the room as well as connect digitally. We know that women's networks are not as good as men's for all sorts of historic reasons, and we're trying to change that. We're trying to change the conversation for women in their careers. It's an unashamedly for-profit business. We feel like women need to make money, get rich, talk about it, and deploy their capital in backing other women so that we can build up our own ecosystem, because things don't change unless women are writing the checks. You know, for Albright, we've raised $42 million of capital to scale the business. And at the beginning of our journey as founders, we were very focused on having 50-50 men, women in our cap table. And if we'd stuck to that, we would have funded one of the loos in one of the buildings. You know, it's still the case that 98% of venture capital partners are male, that only 17% of angel investors in the UK are female. So we have a big, hairy, audacious goal and a big mission. And it's really interesting to see how the pandemic has changed that. I mean, women have been hardest hit by the pandemic. We have twice the mental load of men, not in every household, but definitely in mine.
Definitely.
And, you know, we need to start making a lemonade from the lemons, because our Albright community of 500,000 women, 2/3 of them say that they want to start their own business as a result of the pandemic. So there's a real entrepreneurial spirit, I think, as a result of the point that I made at the beginning on mindset, which is, I think one of the things the pandemic has left us with is a desire to self-determine, is a desire to work in the way we want to work, is a desire to have purpose, actually. And so for that reason, Albright has had a great pandemic in terms of our own scale, but women want, need connections, upskilling, confidence, resilience more than ever. And that's what we're setting out to build.
Cool. That's an awesome goal. And yeah, I do fundamentally believe that on average, women generally make a better like founder of a startup, as in they're just, yeah, they're more empathetic, they're better organized, better at multitasking, and yeah, just better at communicating, which are like the three of the most essential things for running a business. And I think maybe perhaps like slightly less confident in raising money and less likely to sort of oversell things, yeah, which is where you perhaps lose out on a bit of things. But then, yeah, also the network, as in I really struggle as a guy, because I just naturally hang out mostly with guys, even though I love hanging out with women. The reason that you're on this call is because of, I literally went through the list of like 25 women in tech and was like, I need to talk to more women in tech. And like your name was there. I was like, she sounds really bloody cool. Yeah. She could be on my podcast. Yeah. Just because I was like, I need more women, because I naturally just get introduced to men.
Yeah.
With, when, right, I'm not trying. So I've had to like try. And
that's right. And I think Albright, you know, we heard so much in our professional lives that men didn't see women. They either didn't see female founders asking for institutional venture capital. They didn't see women standing up wanting to be CEOs. They didn't have a pipeline. Part of what Albright does is to say, look, they're here. Like, they're here every day. They're in our building, on our digital platform. There's no excuse, actually, because what we're doing is bringing together those women in a way that makes them easier to find. And I think that's really important for how we start to change some of these stats.
Yeah, cool. You mentioned you run physical events where enlightened males are allowed. Yeah. What is an enlightened male?
Oh, and just our way.
How do I become one?
Yeah, well, I hope you are one already. We feel it's very important that you can be celebratory of women without being anti-men. And that has always been in Albright's DNA. We have a male chairman, which caused a reasonable amount of controversy when we appointed him, because he's extremely high profile. Alan Layton, who's chaired Wagamama and Pandora and the co-op and was the CEO of Asda, is our chair and a significant investor in the business. We think without men alongside you on the bus, you don't drive change, and you certainly don't access large sums of capital in the way that we have. And men are very welcome in our spaces. And at any time, kind of looking back at the building, there's probably a third of the people who are in here are men, but they're only here if they're invited in by a woman. And we think that's really important, because this is a space for women to build their network skills and confidence. It's a physical manifestation of the Albright brand. All of the art on the wall is by female artists, the wine behind the bar, the supply chain is female food providers. We have a female head chef. You know, it matters. Spaces can matter. They can stand for something above and beyond just bricks and mortar. And world of purpose, to be able to subvert the traditional gentleman's club is actually very powerful. And it's something that women really want. They want to be in spaces that are tailored for them, and they want to be in there with men, and they want to be able to have male colleagues or male co-founders or boyfriends or husbands or sons or whoever in the building. But it's a building that's by women and for women.
Cool. Yeah, that sounds great. How can a enlightened man or just anyone play a part in building more connections for women?
They need to be thoughtful. They need to do what you have done in order to find me, which is to recognize their own networks and their own unconscious bias. Perhaps means that their own network and connections are mostly male, and they need to make an effort to build their connections with women. And then they need to stand up and be counted. The biggest thing that changes the conversation for female entrepreneurship in the UK is for men to back women, right? You know, it really does. It's for men to back female-led businesses and to say that they believe and to allow women to deliver, because then the ecosystem shifts. So I think it's around awareness and investment. And I think it's also around letting women be heard. You know, it's something that we talk about a lot at Albright is to how to be heard. And frankly, that has shifted during the pandemic, because how are you heard and how do you make your presence felt on Zoom is often a real challenge for women. And I think what we teach our women to do is to stand up and support other women, to echo and reinforce what's said in a meeting. To, you know, an agent, and I just do it without even thinking, because we're a double app, but I'll say, you know, well, as Anna said, men can do that for women, right? You can really help to reinforce a woman's contribution. And all of those little things make a real difference to women being heard, backed, promoted. And men have got a really important role to play.
Cool. And yeah, certainly looking for things I can do, and any of our listeners, of course. I think it's just useful for everyone to like be more connected with women and have them doing the things that they're good at and like sit at the table, etc. This makes so much sense.
Today, I'm delighted to tell you about Notion. When you're working at a startup, you don't have time to keep track of the dozens of documents, systems, apps, and tools that you're using every day. That's where Notion comes in, providing one clear central space for your team to stay organized, share information, and do their work. You can all move forward together in one place. Notion is an all-in-one team collaboration tool that combines note-taking, document sharing, wikis, project management, and much more into one space that's simple, powerful, and beautifully designed. For startups, Notion can provide a full-on operating system running every aspect of your company, keeping everyone aligned as you grow fast and take on more. And it has a network of millions of users creating brilliant templates and tutorials to inspire you. And I love their goal tracking systems. It's really helped me with my startup as well as everything else that I was already using. So if you're interested and want to find out more, Notion is running a special offer just for startups with $1,000 off the Notion's team plans by going to notion.com/startups. So that's basically a free year of using Notion for a team of 10 people. Again, that's notion.com/startups to receive $1,000 in free credit to use Notion with your team. That's $1,000 of value when you go to notion.com/startups.
What would you say have been some of the mindsets that have been key to your success that you haven't mentioned already around just having an entrepreneurial ethos and sort of immigrant mentality around just having to be successful and stuff?
Yeah. So our book, which is called Believe, Build, Become, How to Supercharge Your Career, was re-released by Penguin this week, actually, because we've written some extra chapters around the pandemic and our reflections on how women have and can continue to supercharge their career, even during a time of crisis. And we talk a lot about the three G's in the book. And they're the things that I think I focus on in my own mindset and the mindset of others that we're either looking to hire, or Anna and I invest personally in a lot of startups, only female-led startups, because we think we have to put our money where our mouth is. So the first G is graft, for which we need hard work. And I think that you just can't underestimate how much work it is starting a business. And there really is a, you know, I'm all for balance, but there is a direct correlation between hours in, effort in and out, and particularly at the very beginning. So I think it's appreciating that.
Yeah.
And that's okay. But it isn't, without that, it just isn't going to happen, right?
Yeah.
So I think mindset wide, the thing Anna and I really have in common is we work really hard and we have found a thing to work on that's really fun. So I think don't underestimate the hours in, and therefore that should actually be a lesson to founders to really choose wisely what the business is, because you're going to have to spend a long time talking and thinking about it. So pick well. And the second G is Grace. It's actually the name of my middle daughter. And I really think that grace under pressure is one of the hardest things as an entrepreneur. And it's something that I've learned as I've got older, because it's very easy to be very reactive, particularly because nobody's mindset is ever quite like yours, or nobody's sense of what output should be is quite like yours. So AKA, it's like, just don't lose your rag. And I've had to learn that lesson as I've got older. So I think grace and being gracious is really important. That's also around paying it forward and investing in your network and helping other people, even at times when you don't have the time, right? So I think grace is important and underrated. And the final G, and everybody talks about this, and there's a book that if your listeners haven't read, I would thoroughly recommend, along with ours, obviously, which is Grit, which is the Angela Duckworth book, which, you know, is really recommended reading. I'm actually a big fiction reader, not a non-fiction reader at all. And I'm on the board of the Women's Prize for Fiction. Yeah. So I don't read a lot of non-fiction, but I think that book had a really profound effect on me, and also on the way that I think about my children, actually, which is that all the data shows that grit trumps genius every day. And I really try for that with my kids, and I try for that with our teams. And my God, we've had to have it in spades over the last 18 months, which is, that's what it's about, right? It's about grit. It's about getting up and getting on with it when you don't want to. And as a founder, and bear in mind, this is almost my 23rd year of being a founder. I've been at it for a while.
Wow.
There's no shortcut. And yes, there are always these amazing stories of people who get in and out in a year and a half, and it's all, you know, but generally everybody's grinding it out. And the grit to build the business and build the brand and build the revenue and build the P&L and develop some EBIT and get the exit is working through the pain, the boredom, which is also something that people don't talk about a lot, the highs, lows, and everything else. And Albright is a real piece of practice for me, like ongoing, because you'd think it would be easier now. You know, like, I've had three exits. The last one was a big one. My co-founder was the most well-known woman in media, but it's never easy. We've had all sorts of crap happen and continue to every day. So I think it's about grit, and how do you unpick that? It's about your support network. And again, this is something we write a lot about in our book. If you come into one of the buildings in neon in the hallway, it says Sisterhood Works. And that's our mantra, if you like. It's the name of our podcast series, because we really think it does. It's not just about women. It's about your support network and your community. But it's often about women, because I think for women who are successful, a big part of your success is your game face, right? And it's very hard to explain that to a man, that particularly when I was 25 in my first business, you're walking into a room and nobody's expecting anything from you because you don't look the way that they expect you to look. And I think that you learn very quickly how to punch above your weight and how to develop swagger. But you need the people around you where you can take the mask off. And for me, that network of other female founders, many of whom are well known because we've all grown up together, is the place where I go, this is shit, or we really screwed this up, or I've got a nightmare investor, or I don't know what to do with this board member. I don't, because it's very hard to do that publicly, right? Because publicly, and I was at a big industry event last night, everybody's smashing it, right? How is it? Brilliant. Everyone, Albright's had this amazing pandemic. Yeah, it's amazing. It's great, isn't it? I mean, you've got have people around you where you can give the real. And yeah. I think that's the reality to what grit is. It's about setting yourself up to keep going.
Yeah, it's hard. I've definitely had a up and down year myself on my business and things. And sometimes I have no idea how I'm still going. But then still am for now. And right. It's cool. And yeah, especially when there's like nothing stopping you sometimes to continue. And certainly that's something I've found in terms of one of the nice things about running a podcast is that I'm just curious to talk to more people. And once I've recorded it, I have to release it. But by the time I've released it, I've probably recorded another episode with someone else. So it's kind of, it has to continue. Whereas like when I'm writing, It has to be purely self-driven. Every single day I have to turn up to write. And if I don't, no one tells me off or stops me. And like, there's nothing, I don't owe anything to anyone to make myself write. So I have to somehow think of a different way, like making it more public, of like ownership of that problem. Otherwise it's hard to keep that grit.
However you're accountable. But the other part of that, which is very boring, is it's about routine. I've got my routine, whatever's happening. I get up, I get in my Lycra and I train every day. And I box 4 days a week and I lift weights the other 3 days a week, and not, like, whatever has gone on, however late, whatever the kids are doing, that's my mindset. You know, I'm an early riser, right? Like, whatever it is that works for you. But I think that routine for me is the thing. I write everything down the night before, I tick off a list. I'm very structured. That's a muscle that you can come back to, right? And for me, I've got to hit that punch bag, like literally hit the punch bag with someone's face on the end. And that's my mechanism. But find whatever your mechanism is. But I find without a routine, you know, for example, if I don't train in the morning, I don't train. So what is your version of that? And just the more you can live in a routine, the easier it is to create the small goals that make you personally accountable to your routine, right? Because that's just what you do.
Definitely. I did like a blog like every day for 3 months when I lived in Israel, because I didn't really do that much in the evenings, like social wise. And so I got up at 6 a.m., went for a run for an hour, then wrote for an hour, meditated for a bit, and then like turned up at 10 a.m. to go do work. And 6 o'clock was finished, ate some dinner, did a bit more work, and then went to bed. And it was like, it was a great routine for writing. But then in London, I'm running around seeing people in the evenings and stuff, and I can't stay out too late. And then I'm like, crap, the day is already starting at 10 a.m. And so I need a different routine for where I'm better at these things. But yes, that is something I need to sort out with my life. Thank you. Good. Totally agree. Then in terms of other things that you may have been learning, so what failures or challenges have you really felt and had to overcome? And what were the lessons that you've had from that?
Oh, God, I mean, something goes wrong every day, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The business that you start with is never the business that you finish with. You're endlessly pivoting the model. You're endlessly looking for a breakthrough. You know, Love Home Swap's a good example, actually. So for the first 2 years of running the business, it was the beginning of the sharing economy. We had a business model that was, I'm London, you're Paris. You want to come to London, I want to go to Paris. We seal the deal. It's a subscription model. There are different tiers of subscription. And it was fine. And we're good at making noise about things, but it wasn't really flying. And then you're looking for the unlocker. And the unlocker was, and this is one of the things I think that's a really important lesson when you're trying to build something, be in the world. Look around at every other business model, you know, however old fashioned. And there was a sort of gradual moment, again, through serendipity, through meeting someone. Actually, this is quite like timeshare, right? If you can kind of remember what timeshare is, which is totally unsexy. But the thing that makes a timeshare work is it's a three-way, in the sense that I want to go to Paris, but you want to go to Mexico, and the person in Mexico wants to come to London, right? That's how a timeshare works. So essentially you're banking time in a place that's a, you know, Easter week in Cabo or whatever it is you bought. If we could unlock that, we can really unlock liquidity. I mean, it sounds really obvious now, but sometimes things just aren't obvious because you've got a really fixed view of what a model is. And once we could execute on that, it totally transformed the scale of the business. It totally transformed every single KPI. And then we ended up selling to Wyndham, the hotel group, which owned RCI, the biggest timeshare group in the world. So it's not so much about failures, because I don't ever really see it like that. If you're starting a startup and you're ready to chalk the failures, you're never going to. I mean, the whole thing's a mess at the beginning, right? Every single thing that can go wrong goes wrong. You never have enough money, make terrible hiring decisions, which we continue to do. Because you're hiring in a hurry, and when you're raising capital, you've sold the dream, and then you don't have the people, and you aren't, right? So there's all that. That's just like bait. That's just life. But I think just read everything, turn up to everything, meet as many people as possible, and you will figure it out. But your mindset can't be one of success or failure, right? Yeah, every day's a learning day without sounding too trite. And of course, some days you just can't be bothered with that. But I really feel that that's why my businesses have been successful, because I'm not emotionally attached to where I start. And I'm very, very happy to learn, plagiarize, network, say, do you know what? They're doing it better than, I mean, even today, I just had a meeting with someone this morning where I've been trying to solve for something, and it's these two really young girls out of Scandinavia, and they've nailed it. And you've got to be open to go, do you know what? We need to just rip up our stuff, because what they're doing is better, is right. And maybe we can bring them in, and maybe. So I think there's a point about collaboration, open-mindedness, and being in the world that means that it's all a journey, right? I think the other point on that I say a lot to the female founders, you know, that we meet and mentor through Albright, try and celebrate the successes as you go. Like, try and bank a good day. Because if the only thing that determines your success is your exit, it's a very, very long haul. You know, very long. And not everyone even gets there. So try and find a way. And sometimes we don't practice what we preach at Albright because we're so busy, to go, that was a win. Or the team should feel really proud of this. Or actually, the idea that there might be this thing is enough for today. I think you've got to bake in the mini successes to the very long haul.
Yeah, that's a huge one that I've certainly struggled with a lot. And the prior advice was also great around being open-minded, and just everything is kind of a failure, but it's also a success. Like, when things are going wrong, it's like it's just pushing you in the more correct direction,
right.
And
right.
You can definitely be positive about it. But yeah, I do find that really hard, trying to celebrate when things go well. Because you've already sort of rising your expectations, which is kind of the flaw of an entrepreneur, is like not being satisfied with whatever is there, because if you kind of want to change it, but then you're kind of endlessly chasing things. So do you set targets that you're like, okay, we're going to celebrate when we hit this target, which probably should take a month, but if it's 2 months, we'll still celebrate it then? Or do you kind of like 1 month cadence be like, cool, well, this is what we achieved this month. Isn't this awesome? And still celebrate that? Or is it kind of random? How can you like,
bit more fluid.
Have more.
So sometimes it's KPI driven, but sometimes it's, you know, we pull a lot off at Albright. The team pulls a lot off in terms of content and impact and delivery and feedback. And we just try to have a culture of sharing and praising. And then for AJ and I, we're so lucky with each other because we really love each other. And we have a really good laugh together, and we're just mates. We've got a shared sort of dark sense of humor. And so we try to go, let's just go out and have some dinner and some drinks and raise a glass to us. And we do a lot of telling each other we love each other. You know, it's a relationship. I mean, it's the biggest relationship of your life. Not that my husband's not an important person in my life. You spend more time with your co-founder than you do. Yeah. So you have to invest in that as well as you would any relationship.
That's a very important thing. Is that something that you were surprised by when you started the business, or did that kind of become obvious? Because I think some people are like, they don't think about that so much when they're choosing co-founders. Have you had any lessons from co-founders? Because you certainly said you've had some issues with hiring and things.
Well, I've never really had a co-founder like I have with AJ, because even though I worked with my brother in my last business, I was the founder. I think I've seen a lot of things not work out, and I sit on a lot of boards. And my advice would be that you've got to pick someone where their skill set's totally different to yours, so you don't tread on each other's toes, where you have the ultimate respect for them in their careers and as a human, but where you have a shared purpose, but also shared behavior in terms of norms, by which I mean AJ and I are very level. We don't shout. We've got long fuses. We see the funny side of most things, and even when they're bad. And we've got quite short memories, both of us. So no matter how awful something was, the next morning, tomorrow's another day, and we're on. We don't brood, we don't hold grudges, we don't. I think when I've seen things go really wrong is when you've got someone who shouts and someone who doesn't, or someone who vents and someone who doesn't, or someone who broods and someone who doesn't. It's that, right? It's like a relationship. AJ and I have got very different skills, and we've had really different backgrounds. And we've got different styles. I mean, she's good cop, I'm bad cop, until we're not. And that kind of confuses people. But with each other, our behavior and our behavioral norms and our sense of how you respond to bad things happening is very, 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 very similar. And I think that's what keeps us on track, right?
Mm. Yeah, it's really... So I've had an issue with my business partner. I've now had to stop running the company with him. But we've been best friends since we were 10, and that's never had really an issue as a relationship. But then he is much more reactive than me, and he's much more like... He sort of comes from the background where, like, you do shout if you're a bit annoyed, whereas if I'm shouting, like, serious shit is going wrong, like, next level. If so, if someone's shouting near me, I'm, like, super passively, like, oh my god, take it super seriously, whereas he just shouts just to get anything done, and, like, that's so right. It completely conflicted as, like, two working styles.
Something to watch for, because it's very triggering for the person who isn't like that, and the person who is like that is very frustrating because they feel like there's not a lot of resolution. So I think figuring that out is really important.
Yeah, it was a hard one. But we worked out that we should just come back to being friends, and that was great. So that was also hard to get to, but we managed, so I was pretty happy about that. But that was a lesson that I learned the hard way, as we do. If you could tell yourself something when you're 20 that would be super useful, is there anything you've learned lately that you're like, if only I knew this, then this, I would have saved myself a lot of stress?
Yeah. I think it's something I talk about a lot when I talk to girls and young women, which is, I think, don't worry so much about being liked. I think that's something that I worried a lot about as a young founder, whether everybody liked me and whether I was what people thought of me. And one of the great things about getting older is that you just don't care as much. And I think that as women, we can hold back, can hold ourselves back because of that fear of being disliked. So Anna and I have a line that we use with each other, and we use in our book a lot, which is about having a rhino hide. And that would be my advice and lesson to young girls and young people: develop your rhino hide.
Yeah. Cool. I mean, it comes across as a bit of a weird compliment if I tell you you have skin like a rhino. But yes, I totally agree. Just sort of being more convicted around, like, what it is that you're doing, and not really worrying if everyone's going to love you for it or not, because you can't please everyone anyway.
Yeah.
And you can cause yourself a lot of pain and wasted effort, which is something that I also need to get better at. I'm pretty metrosexual for a guy, I swear. I'm like... more on the female side of things. So, like, all advice for women is really good for me, I find. Nice. So, yeah, I kind of really fascinated by how you've become on the board for the fiction, women's fiction judging.
Yeah.
I've got the details, but I haven't scrolled to where they are.
Women's fiction,
Yes, exactly. How did you get onto that? Was that just like a random meeting as well, that you just happened to be in the right place at the right time? Or
not so much.
Did you hustle for it?
I think a big part of what happens if you lean into it, and as you get older, as you build out your personal brand, and I'm hugely passionate about the arts, particularly theatre and books, which is my sort of what makes my heart sing in lots of ways. And I was on the board of the Hampstead Theatre for 6 years and chaired the development board there, because I think it's really important for business people to have a responsibility for ensuring that the arts continue to be funded in the UK, because it's one of our biggest exports, the creative industries. And also, I love theatre. And through that, I met an author called Kate Moss, who's one of our most prolific female fiction authors, and founded the Women's Prize 26 years ago now, because it was in the year when the Booker Prize had no women on the shortlist. And yeah, I was just connected in with her, and she asked me whether I would join the board, and I've been on the board for 3 years now. And I love it. It all kind of fits together. It's obviously, it's about women and women writers and showcasing great female talent, but also gives me a compelling reason to read a lot, which I do anyway. But it's also just a brilliantly curated list each year. And I think it's part of this sort of standing up and be counted, to be really clear on what your purpose is. And if I can help more women writers be known, be read, make money, because that's okay in the arts, it's critical in the arts, then that's something that's really important. So I'm hugely passionate about it. Albright can really help, because we can house a lot of what happens with the prize, and we can house the judges when they're judging, and we can support the prize. And that's a way of making Albright really count for things that matter for women, of which I think the arts is really crucial.
Yeah, cool. That's a really nice explanation and sort of parallel to something I've been kind of feeling lately, around just like reflecting on my own life now that I'm turned 30 and I spent 10 years being entrepreneurial, but also just following my other pursuits, I seem to always end up in a choir wherever I end up living and sort of getting involved with people who are artist-y. And I'm now in a co-working space full of musicians, and that sort of helps them turn their art into a business rather than relying on record labels. And there's also some like tech entrepreneurs that are in like creative industries and stuff. And I'm just having lots of fun being here. And like, I'm in a recording studio right now recording this podcast, and I just sort of expect I'm just going to be more involved in music and things anyway. And it's always been on my like life agenda to do an album. And then for my interest, I've been doing a podcast where I read a book a week with my co-founder, where we just go into subjects we're really interested in. We do like a deep dive. So we did like ancient philosophy. We did one on equality and diversity. We're doing one currently on investing, but it's led to my co-founder getting a job at a venture capital firm because he's super into like gaming and crypto and stuff. And it's just been interesting, like just doing the things that you're kind of interested in as like your side hobbies ends up kind of giving you so many more opportunities to then get paid lots of money to formally do the thing that you really enjoy doing anyway. And you don't think of it that you could even do it as a career. Cool. Well, good luck. Thank you so much for the time, and it was a super inspiring conversation.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
Thank you for joining us this week on the Growth Mindset Podcast. Before you head on to another episode, what's your biggest aha moment from today's discussion? You can share with us your insights and join us on Reason FM. Reason FM is a social podcasting app and the best way to discover new podcasts, connect with hosts and other listeners. Also, don't forget to tune into the Wiser Than Yesterday podcast with me and my co-host Nico, and we expose you to a different perspective and dive into the world's most thought-provoking and inspiring books. That's all for this episode, and with that, keep learning and keep growing.